Hello, you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show with me, Alison Spittle. This week's guest is Richie Sadlier. Richie was a football player for a little while and had to retire, and has then retrained in the field of mental health. And he's a really, really clever and astute guy, and I'm so happy to have him on my podcast. He's also really funny too. We did the podcast in front of a live audience in the Workmen's. I want to say thank you very much to that live audience. You were great. And we are organising some more live shows later on this year, so keep an ear out. And sure, look, listen to the show, and I'll talk to you after. This is the
Thank you so much for coming. So guys, are you ready for our first guest? Yeah? Woo! I'm excited. Okay, wait there until I get my breath. Hello. Okay. Are you ready for Mr. Richie Sadlier, everybody? Woo! Amazing. How are you? I'll give you a hug. Oh, Richie, you're so fine. Has anyone sang that to you before?
No, you're the first one.
Am I? Yeah. But it sounds so much like Mickey. Like, I feel... Do you get any songs sung to you on a regular basis?
No, the first time I ever had songs sung about me, it wasn't particularly complimentary.
Oh, no. What, you got a football chant sung about you?
Well, my name wasn't in it just any time I touched... I was 18, a scrawny little devil, no confidence, and I was going to get pushed around the pitch in all the matches, and the crowd really, really, really didn't take to me.
Which club was this?
This is at Millwall.
Oh.
So after a while, the kind of patience ran out, so any time I would run onto the pitch before the game, they would kind of boo my entry onto the pitch. Just doing the warm-up when there's only very few people in the stadium. This is about a half hour before kickoff. When my name is called out, they boo. And then when I touch the ball, the whole stadium together would chant, shit, shit, shit. Because inevitably, any time I touch the ball, because it was so low in confidence and playing so poorly, I'd give it away. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it's nice when people appreciate you.
Yeah.
Your song was slightly nicer.
I think so. Yeah. I think more football fans should be complimentary in their music.
Millwall fans are very very generous with their feedback.
They are.
If you do well, they'll sing your name. If you don't do well, they'll also sing about it.
Yeah, like my dad's a big football fan, and when I say football fan, loves a bit of
fighting.
Bit of fighting. Okay, in the 80s, he was mad into the fighting at football games. That was like his thing he'd like to do. And he told me Millwall are dirty bastards when it comes to fighting. They're very good at fighting. And so are Norwich. Norwich as a football club, you'd be very afraid being an away fan going to Norwich because they know their own area. You're very not used to being in Norwich. And the fans are used to being in Norwich, and they would like do guerrilla warfare when it. That's what I heard. They do guerrilla warfare when it comes to a bit of football fighting.
Yeah, Millwall were very good at that too.
Were they?
I love your surprise tone, like you don't know.
I know. tell me more.
Yeah, interesting fact. Millwall fans are scumbags. I remember when I first got the call. I was 15 or 16, and scout came to my house and asked my parents would I be able to go over on trial. And when I told my mates, they all kind of gave me funny looks, going, Jesus, you know, they're all hooligans and did they not hate the Irish and you're not going to be intimidating. And all this kind of reputational stuff kind of went before them. And I went over and then I signed. And when my mates used to come over, and they come over quite a lot, they used to say to me, this is kind of mid-90s, late-90s, they'd say, you know, should we deliberately keep our voices down in case our Irish accents would be heard by the other fans and, you know, we get ourselves in trouble. And I kind of say, lads, that's a decision you make yourselves. I've enough to be worried about with the fucker shouting at me on the pitch. But yeah, it's even in my debut, actually, one of the Millwall fans ran from behind the goal at one end to attack the referee, and another fan ran from the stand behind the same goal to attack our manager, who at this point was kind of had a ring of security and policing around him, because we were on a bad run of results. And when you're in a bad run of results, you all become legitimate targets in various different ways.
Oh, my gosh.
But I was 18. I was kind of going, this is amazing. This is brilliant. It wasn't exactly how I pictured it when I was 10 and 12, dreaming of being a footballer. But when you're in it, and the energy and the buzz and the adrenaline and all that, you're kind of going, there's nothing else would make me feel like this.
Were you ever tempted to do like an Eric Cantona on it? Just run into the fans and kick them in the face?
I'm long enough out of it now, I can answer that question honestly. Absolutely. we'd have scenarios in, because, and most players in most clubs would say this, you live in the area where near your club, so most people in that area will support that club, so they'll be aware of you. And in the bad runs, when you're not doing well, they're not shy of coming up in the middle of the street during the day, you're at a restaurant, you're in a pub, wherever you are, you're with your mates, your girlfriend, parents, doesn't matter. They come up and they'd be full of drink or coke or something, and absolutely just load of abuse. And there'd be loads of nights you go, I really love to have a go back.
Yeah.
But I'll phrase it that way. But you just know that when it gets to Monday morning, if you're in any incident with anyone, it doesn't matter how provoked you were or how unfairly treated you were or how justifiable anything you did over the weekend is, if you did something wrong, you were accountable. So you just kind of had to bite your tongue all the time, which is hard some nights, but I never acted on any of it.
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, I go to watch West Bromwich Albion twice a year, and I would get the train from Birmingham to the Hawthorns, and some of the shitheads on the train, like, I want a glass myself, and they're and they're fellow fans of my favourite team. But Jesus, like, some of them, I feel, have no personality apart from their identity as a football. Like, I love football, and I do, I love... I love being around my dad is like calmed down and enjoys football for what it is now, but I love the whole it's almost like mass. You get off the train, you go, especially in West Bromwich, like, because it's full of Desi pubs, which are pubs owned by Asian people. So you have, like, you can have a curry and a pint, but a real nice curry and a pint and a naan, and lovely. You have that at like 12 o'clock in the day, and you're drinking, and it's just, I don't know, I love it. And then going to watch the football, having a good shout, and just, you know, and the amount of 8-year-olds that know the C word, they'll just shout it out. Do you know, you don't get that at mass. Yeah. Like, it's a great call and response. Yeah, you know. Yeah. Peace be with you.
There was loads of that, and I think when you first see it, you're kind of sitting there going, Jesus, like, what?
It's a
shock to begin with. Then after a while, when you're every week, and you're just used to seeing 6 or 8-year-olds sitting on their dad's lap or standing next to the dad doing kind of that sign to the referee, and the C word and the F word and maybe a little bit of racist stuff or whatever. You look around and go, I can see maybe why that little 6-year-old grows up to behave like the 30-year-olds all around, because that's their upbringing. And like you said, it is, like, it's a massive deal. Like, a lot of people are completely indifferent to sport, never watch a game of football in their life, but then there's a load of people who it's the most important thing. Their identity is, I'm a football fan, I'm a West Brom supporter, a Millwall supporter, and how the team does at the weekend dictates their mood all week.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
And I've always kind of, and I'm guilty of it myself, of, like, if West Brom are doing well, then I feel like I'm doing well. I've contributed fuck all to West Bromwich. I'll be doing
your
well.
Your self-esteem is up a little. You're
it is. Yeah. There's a cock in my step. There's like, hey, guys, we're not getting relegated this year. Yay. The mad thing about being, the great thing about being a West Bromwich Albion supporter is you get relegated and promoted a lot. So there's a big change in emotions all the time. And I remember, like, when West Bromwich Albion first got promoted to the Premier League, I was about 12. My sister, I think, was about 6 or something like that. And my dad, West Brom, in order to get promoted, had to beat, I think it was Crystal Palace, or Crystal Palace had to beat Wolves. But Wolves had to lose, West Brom had to win, 2 separate games. But Wolves and West Brom are local rivals, and they hate each other so much. And some Wolverhampton fans, West Brom got promoted, some Wolverhampton fans ended up in West Bromwich, and there was riot police with shields and Alsatians and horses. And I'm like a quiet Irish girl from the country, and I started crying. I didn't know what was going on. And my sister's six and just going, wah! Like that. We're both throwing our heads off. My dad is pissed.
Yeah, passion is a great defence for anything.
It's a great defence, isn't it?
It means so much to me. I'm passionate.
But yeah, so like, did you
we got used to seeing scenes like that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
It was just the norm.
It must have been the norm.
It was, and usually after a while I realised, like the security in the stadium, they're so, they have to be so kind of vigilant. I remember one day, I was 17 or 18, so I wasn't in the first team, and I was sitting with three or four of the other U team lads, and we were all in club tracksuits, and somebody wanted change of a tenner, I think. So
somebody, as in
one of the lads,
lads
are chatting. And someone owed somebody money, and said, "I've only got a tenner, and I need 2 fivers." So we were all. The lad said, "You know, have you got anyone got 2 fivers?" So we all kind of took out wallets or rustling money, and something changed hands. Within 10 minutes, then two security came up and pulled the two lads out. They thought they were doing a drug deal. So right. They're that, like every single kind of seat in the stadium is being monitored, because if the club isn't seen to stop this, the club gets sanctioned. And there's a load of people in the ground who are just itching for a fight.
There are, yeah. A few people I know have been banned from Football Association stadiums.
You're keeping good company?
They're so upset. It was like they went to jail. But they didn't, but they were banned. And it was just funny how, like, my dad would talk about them as if, like, poor Charlie, now he can't go to the FA Cup semi-final. All because he bottled someone. And you're like, I think Charlie shouldn't be allowed in this ground. They're just like a simple old bottling, like, as if,
massive. I nearly didn't stick with being a footballer
because of that.
Well, no, there was a load of things. In the first few months, I went over in August 96, and I turned 18 in the following January, and I just wasn't enjoying it. All my mates were in college, and they were ringing me all the time telling me how good it was, and you're not really meant to have that much of a social life when you're a footballer. They ask you, they kind of urge you to stick with footballers, because non-footballers have, you know, don't have the discipline and all the rest of it. So there wasn't much going on at weekends, and I was homesick, and I wasn't doing well, and I thought the coaches were picking on me, and blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And I kind of convinced myself, I said, I'm not good enough anyway. I'm making all these sacrifices, and I'm not going to make it, so I should just pack up and leave. And I rang my family on a Tuesday night towards the end of January and just let it out. I think my mum answered the phone and said, let it all out. I said, I'm not good enough. I don't enjoy it. I'm going home. Sod this. And she said, maybe just sleep, maybe go to sleep on it, see how you feel in the morning. Don't make any decision like that, you might regret it. So I slept on it, and I did feel better the next morning. And I felt much better then when the coach on the Thursday said, listen, you've been doing really well. We're going to get you to train with the first team on Friday. I'd never done this before. I was like, fuck, this is amazing. And I said, listen, if the game goes well on Saturday, we're going to name you in the squad, and if the game goes well, we can put you on, so you're going to make your debut on the Saturday. This is fucking amazing. Like, this is like, so that's how it panned out. I went to train on Friday with the first team, showed up in the stadium on the Saturday, was named as a sub, and with 25 minutes to go, he put me on. And I went from being as low as I was on the Tuesday to as high as I could possibly be on the Saturday. About 3 years later, I was at some family do, and my mum had a few glasses of wine in her. And we were just reminiscing about certain things, and that phone call came up, and I was like, Jesus, isn't it great I stayed, and imagine how differently things would have been. And she just leans in and she goes, do you know I made a phone call? And I said, what do you mean? I said, so my mum got off the phone, rang my schoolboy manager from the team I played in Dublin, and said, listen, Richie's struggling. Relayed the conversation. Maybe had a go at him a little bit, saying, listen, when we sent him over, you gave me assurances he was going to be looked after. Turns out he's not been. So the manager from Dublin rang the chief scout of Millwall, relayed the conversation. The chief scout spoke to the first team manager. And that was the reason I got called into the first team. So there's a load of footballers who can like claim that they got their big break because they showed like amazing potential. And like they wowed everyone with their technique and their skill. And my God, this fella's going to be a player. Literally, I got my break in football because I got on the phone and cried to my mum.
Oh my God, that's
So I owe it all to that. So anytime I do, you know, it's good to talk messages to lads in school. So that's what happened to me when I talked.
What an amazing mammy. Mm. What an absolute fixer. I tell you, the nicest thing my mammy has ever done for me, but the most protective thing my mum has ever done for me was I was in Mullingar. I was going to the ATM machine in a petrol station, and there was a group of like 5 14-year-olds, and I would have been in my 20s at this point. And one of them called me fat, and mammy heard him. And drove her car towards them and tried to run them down. So I can understand.
My mum just made phone calls. Yours was prepared to kill people.
I thought she wasn't going it was a very short distance. She couldn't get that much speed up, you know. I mean, it would be a very slow running over. That's so cool about your ma. So cool. What was it like in the dressing room of a first senior team compared to when you were doing it with underage teams?
Well, the biggest difference is the underage teams are all your own age.
Yeah.
You're at the same stage of life. You're 16, 17 or 18. You're all the same together. And then the first dressing room I was in, I think I was 18. There might have been one 19-year-old, but everyone else was 24, 25 upwards. That just happened to be the makeup of the squad at the time. So you just kind of feel completely... I just felt like I was totally... Not out of my depth, but like you just feel like you don't belong because you don't really have friendships with lads who are 25 when you're 18.
No.
I didn't at the time anyway, so... But I loved it. Like, it was... Like, I have a load of memories from Millwall which were kind of bonkers, which wouldn't have come... Certainly with any other job other than football, but often you wouldn't get it in any other club other than Millwall. But
they are special.
They are, and it is, I know I was slagging the fans early and all that, but they kind of revel in their position of just being real kind of anti-establishment, and like the song they sing is No One Likes Us, We Don't Care.
Yeah.
And they love that. So when you're in it and you're doing well and you feel like you belong and you feel part of the team, which I did for a load of years after that, like it was the best feeling ever. Like, it was how I imagined it would be when I was 12. But then the bad days are really, really bad because it's a job that means loads to you. Like, it means everything.
What was it like going back to Ireland, playing for Millwall, like, being in your home place? Like, did people treat you differently?
Not really. Well, I would always keep my head down. I wouldn't have been going around kind of shouting about myself at any point, but...
I don't know many that would.
There was plenty in my dressing room there who would have been.
Really?
You know, you get lads who kind of would live up to the stereotype of what some people might think of a footballer.
Yeah. I think that's going, though. I think, you know, Balotelli.
Yeah.
Like, I used to love him.
Really? Why him?
Because, like, he's throwing money out of a car and driving into a women's prison for no reason. And he was questioned. And he's like, I just want to have a look around. And it's like, it's a women's prison. And I feel like those people are going out of football because it's so professional. And it has to be. And they're trying to drive out some of the bonker stuff out of football, which I think they should. Mm. I think that's a good step. But I think there's not many... I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking about this in a bad way because I used to, in the 90s, there was lots of characters like Gaza and stuff. But actually, when you think about it, there was a lot of problems. It's like the local person in your village that you think is eccentric, but they're actually mentally unwell and they're not getting the help they need. Mm. Do you know? And it's like that.
But it's hard. Like
talked myself out of it there.
What the lads have now, which I wouldn't have had or anyone before me, like there's just so much scrutiny on them now because everyone, there's dozens of podcasts released daily. There's blogs, there's the pressure on the media to write something fresh every day. In so many different outlets means anything that anyone says or does, it's a potential for, you know, material to talk about. So, and I'm guilty of it. I'm in the media now and anything that, anyone says, okay, this is a topic for a column, and we just overanalyze everything. So if anyone does anything interesting, which fits under the category of, you know, he's a character, he usually gets hammered.
Yeah, maybe it's just because I thought they were great. I didn't think they were getting hammered.
Yeah.
How would you have dealt with it as a young lad, if you played football now? Like you're 18 now, and you're in Millwall. How different would it be?
So if my career went exactly the same, so got in the team at 18 and was really bad. So instead of just the thousands in the stadium chanting shit, I'd imagine
you'd be getting tweets.
There's all that. So
at Richie Sadler, shit.
Yeah, yeah. So you'd there'd be no escape from it.
Yeah.
Because there's loads of different ways that people can contact you now who you've never met. And if they think you're shite and they're as willing to tell you as Millwall fans are, you're going to get told that, I don't know, countless hundred times every day. So I reckon that would have been more difficult.
Yeah.
But of course, the flip side to that is just don't have Twitter. Just don't engage in any of that stuff. But I reckon that must be hard.
I'd say that it must be hard as a young lad to kind of do. Because you, and when you said that you kind of felt different enough from your older peers when you were in the dressing room, I suppose there's a way to keep in contact with your young friends is with social media, and if that's gone, then you must feel very alone.
Like even my way of contacting lads when I was, I sound like an elf when I say this, but I used to get letters from my younger sisters in England, and I used to write letters back to them, and I didn't have a mobile phones weren't around, I think in 96, I don't think I had one till about 99 or 2000 or something. But I would use the house phone in the digs that I was staying in. At 6 p.m., calls were cheaper. So from 6 p.m. to like 9:30, 5 nights a week, I'd be on the phone to people from Dublin. That was mainly how my wages were spent for the first 6 months. It was like I was in a different world. On my going away night, and my mate regularly gets slagged about this, we all went into town with a few pints or whatever, and then we ended up back at my mate's house, and mid-conversation, we were in the kitchen, it's about 3 a.m, he just the two of us, he just turned around and walked out the back door into the garden and just left me standing there, and I said, what the hell's going on here? So I went out after him, and he was crying. And I was like, what's up? He was wondering, what did I just say, or whatever? He goes, you're going away. He says, yeah, no. And then he just goes this immortal line, which he's never been allowed to forget. He goes, you may as well be dead. Because back then, like, none of us had moved out of the housing estate. We'd all been in school every year together. Nobody went anywhere for longer than a week. You just came back, and I was getting this one-way flight to London the following day. You're kind of going into the unknown, going, how's this going to pan out?
Yeah, that's true. It's almost like, you're not at the social network part, but you're not also at the part where people write ballads for you when you leave. Like, you know, in the...
No, I wasn't at that level.
Oh, Richie. And so how long did you play for Millwall for?
I left at 24 because I had a hip injury.
Okay.
So I retired, stopped altogether. I hurt my hip when I was 23, and I spent 18 months kind of getting a couple of operations and a load of injections and painkillers and a load of different things, just to try and kind of mainly prove the surgeons wrong, who were all kind of telling me, you're not going to come back from this. So I, right up until the last day, I kind of bullshitted to everyone. I'm grand, I'll be fine. You know that thing you think you should do as a bloke or maybe as a footballer? I'll be fine, I'll overcome this. I've got the resilience or the strength or whatever. So I kept telling everyone this. So I didn't let on to anyone that on the inside I was really, really shitting myself that this was about to end. So I remember I went in on a Wednesday morning, and I lived with my girlfriend and a mate of ours. Neither of them knew. My parents didn't know. My agent didn't know. None of the teammates, not one person in the world knew that I was going in just to retire. So I went into the medical staff and just said, listen, I've kind of been lying to you. Do you remember I was telling you I was okay? I'm not. Like, basic things I can't do, so there's no way I can get back playing football. And then I went home then. I just sent a text to everyone saying, listen, I finished. And the last line of the... I said more than I'm finished, but I said, don't ring me, I can't be arsed talking about it, because I just didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to deal with it at all. So here I am 20 years later still talking about it.
No.
But it was really hard. Like, I was all over the place for a long, long, long time. Just having to readjust from having what I had to not really knowing what I had then. And not really preparing for anything. Do you know when you're a kid and you have this one thing, and your identity is set from the age of 8?
Yeah.
And like any family do, I went to uncles and aunts. They would ask me about football, and even in school when I get in trouble with teachers, I'd get out of it because they want to know about football. And
yeah,
it was everything. It was, I'm going to be this thing, and then I had to leave it then.
Yeah.
which is tough.
I'd say it really is tough.
Mm.
I find that.
God, the mood's gone down a little bit here.
Sure. Fuck them. Just me and you. It's grand. And I've always wondered about that, about like the whole identity as a footballer. Like, my identity is like being a comedian, and like I don't know whether I'm getting a second series of my sitcom.
When will you know?
Probably like this week, to be honest with you. It's kind of a crunch time. And I'm kind of okay with it not happening. I've kind of accepted it. But I went to a funeral of my boyfriend wrote it together. I went to a funeral of my boyfriend's granny and all of the family. Now, you know, 16 cousins and aunts are like, when is there going to be a second series? Mm-hmm. Can't wait for this. And I'm just going, I don't know. And I know. Probably not. Right. You know what I mean? As much as a chance of your granny getting up and having a jig is probably it's gonna be with it. But that's the identity you have, and you feel like not putting a downer on people either. Mm. And do you know
the thing as well, because it's a public thing, that while the good days are really good to share with everyone, people are aware of the bad days.
Yeah.
Like, if things don't go your way, a lot of people know. If you don't get the series, everyone's going to know. When you play badly, like, everyone knows. So that's just something you have to kind of deal with.
It is. I wonder, like, when you were playing badly, and this goes for, like I'd say a lot of comedians probably know at this point, like, if it hasn't been announced and getting a second series, probably not going to happen. So I'm kind of, like, I'm looking forward to the time where it's going to be actually stated it's not going to happen. So I can just be real with people, like tell them anything, but like kind of people don't have to ignore it, do you know? Because it's like my friend was sick with cancer, and I kind of never mentioned it to him because I was like, sure, fuck it, he knows, do you know? And I'm not gonna talk much about it. But did you have that when you were retiring with that injury? Like, did people treat you differently? Or
people were so sound and nice, and they kind of, you know, you do that thing when you talk to someone and they tilt their head.
I do.
Yeah, that. The people were tilting their head at me for about 2 years, but just really, really supportive and generous, and going, geez, you know, and over exaggerating how well I did, and then just being really, you know, oh, you were this and you were, you could have been, and no one ever thought that when I was playing, but they say it because you finish. And but it was weird because it was the one thing I didn't want to talk about, but because it was so public, it was all that anyone wanted to ask me about. So that was kind of tricky.
Yeah.
So you just kind of learn ways of just fobbing off the conversation.
Do you literally, yeah.
Yeah, just how are you doing? How's, you know,
how's
your head
your
wrecked?
Life?
Yeah, how are you doing? You well, how's your mind? How's your, whatever, just something.
Yeah.
To get the topic off me. But then after a while, I talking about it, like I'm sitting here chatting now and there's no real emotions involved to talking about it. Like,
no.
When it happened, I was kind of going, Jesus, am I going to cry? Am I, you know, I'm angry, I'm afraid, I'm really full of self-pity, all that kind of stuff. Whereas now it's just something, you know, it's an experience I had, and
yeah,
it led to a lot of other things.
Yeah, like what happens when you declare I retire to the medical lad? Like, did it, like, it's not like all of a sudden your football boots just dissolve away from your feet, like a magic thing, like you're no longer a footballer. But like, what were the first few days after that like? Like, were you given options?
Drunken blur,
nice.
That was my...
To get like a pamphlet going, so now you're retired from football.
I remember actually when I left the manager's office, I spoke to the medical staff in the morning, and I actually said to him, he goes, you know, we're going to have to go up and tell the manager. And I said, listen, and I think I was on the verge of tears anyway in this first meeting. And I said, to be honest, I don't want to have to go to this again. Do you mind telling him? And I'll come in later to do what I have to do. So when I came in later, I he was great, and the assistant was there. And then the assistant, just as I went out the door, he says, what are you going to do now, son? And I just went, I'm going to go to the pub and feel sorry for myself. And he just goes, you deserve it, son. So I went, I did that, yeah.
Yeah?
Did that.
Did you have a few kebabs and stuff? And you're like...
Well, that was the thing. It was like this weird thing going the following morning, going, it matters to nobody if I have a lie-in.
Yeah.
Because I went straight from school to football, and you have to be somewhere you're accountable, everything from, and not just when you're in training, when you're in a job like that, what you do outside the job is still, you're still seen as the responsibility of the football club. They still have a hold on you. Where you socialise and who you're with and how late you're out, they still control that. So when I finished, it was like going, I'm completely free here of any supervision, of anyone looking at me. Which is a good thing in some people's hands and can be a bad thing in other people's hands.
Yeah. Is there an organisation now that kind of like has aftercare for footballers now, or was there one
back then? I'd say now there is. Back then there was nothing.
Right.
Back then there was no real... I don't think there was much of an understanding about how difficult it is for people, because the assumption was, well, we'll get him a job again, or yeah, we'll try and get him into coaching, or give him a bit of media work or something. There was nothing really to address the disappointment, like the emotional bit or the heartache or all the stuff that how you would describe a process like that. And I think now there is, because the more people have gone through it and who talk about it, there's more awareness. And a lot of lads have gone into real, really difficult times, and a lot of that has been made public. So I think the football authorities and clubs and stuff have all kind of belatedly kind of stood up to this and said, actually, we have a duty of care for people after they leave, not just when they're playing and scoring goals.
Yeah, because if you're a parent, I mean, you were a footballer identity since 8. Mm. So, you know, if you're a parent now, you'd be unsure of whether you'd put your child up for going to be seen by scouts or whatever, just in case of what could happen when they're 36 or, you know.
Yeah, but you can't really tell a kid.
Yeah, I know, you can't go. You might become a gambling addict when you're older, yeah, so I can't.
Well, like when you're 16 or 18 and someone puts a contract in front of you, go, if you sign this, you get to have the job you've always wanted.
Yeah.
You get to train every day. But there's not a force in the world that could have stopped me from signing that back then. No, even how everything worked out, even the worst of the bad days, if you'd told me you're going to have these, I still would go, yeah, bring it on. Like, the good days are so good. It's amazing.
That's great. Oh. So what did you what kind of job did you go into after football?
This is such
a typical interview now. I was going to ask you, like, what's your star sign and shit, right, but I'm actually really interested.
Well, I kind of figured, I had this awful realization, goes, fuck, I have no experience of anything at all other than playing football, which is the only thing that I know that I'm now physically incapable of doing. So I had enrolled in a sports science degree, and I figured, better to have a degree than not, and I'm into sports, so sports science degree. So I did that, and then I started working as a football agent.
A football agent?
Yeah. Now, didn't like it at all. I did it for about 7, 8, 9 months or something like that.
What do you fight for when you're a football agent? Travel.
My job was kind of to go around and talk to other players and just to really sell the idea of having the company I worked for represent them.
Okay.
And I didn't mind doing that, because I actually believed the fella who I was working for was a decent fella, so I didn't have to do too much bullshitting. So I did that, but just, I think you have to have certain traits and certain qualities to be an agent. I didn't have them, and I didn't enjoy the job, so I left. And then I ended up, it's a hell of a journey to go from being like a footballer at a club like Millwall to being a psychotherapist, but that's kind of what I've done now.
It's kind of the antidote.
I don't know if I could think of a place that's, in terms of a job, that's more different to what the two roles require. But I somehow ended up getting an interest in that and studying it and learning and training in it. And that's one of the things I do now.
So psychotherapy, how is it different from the other psycho stuff? Because I used to get counseling. I still do, but when I was a teenager, it was free, so I got loads of it, and I was particularly mental at the time. So I got off double German, and I'd be in talking about my feelings.
How did you find it?
I tell you now, I didn't. So I got a few different people. I got a psychoanalyst, and she's a talky back one. Didn't like her. She told my head of year, there was a school trip to Portugal, and I was looking forward to the school trip. And she said, don't let Alison go. She might throw herself off a balcony. I was like, I would not. I am there to holiday. You know? I'm not going to ruin my school's holiday. Do you know? But I did, yeah. So she tried to prevent that. I can probably see that she was being kind, or I was particularly mental at the time. But I didn't like her because of that then. I was like, she's trying to ruin my son holiday. So I'm going to close myself off now and not talk to her.
Did you bin her then after that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, binned her. Yeah, because, like, as well as that, like, when you're a teenager and you have a mental health professional talking to you, you're very cynical, number one. And even if they, like, I remember once, she goes, "Now let's talk more about your mum." And I was like, "She is an angel. Don't you dare pin this on her." So I was like, "God." And the woman was probably just trying to get me to open up about something else. But I got into it. Like, I would go through different professionals at a very quick rate as well. Like, I don't think I had, like, the same person for more than a year. Like, but there was one, and she was lovely. She was like a Cabbage Patch doll, lovely rosy cheeks and curly hair. And she was in her 60s, I'd say. And she was lovely. I loved her because she didn't talk back or anything. She was just like, "Okay, And then she'd write. So, and I presume there were compliments about me. "This girl is totally sane. Ain't nothing wrong with her."
You prefer the ones that said nothing?
I did, which is weird. I would prefer someone that does me back stuff now. But at the time, I think it's maybe because I was very self-involved or something, that I felt that whatever I was telling this person, I needed to be listened to. But I didn't necessarily need feedback to improve my life, because my life was great.
You were like, "I've got this."
Yeah, exactly. I don't even need to see you. Yeah, but now I do stand-up comedy, so that kind of itches that that scratch.
I work with teenagers now. That's who I see. Yeah.
So did you set out to work with teenagers, or was something you fell into? Or?
No, I kind of started in 2010, and then when I finished up training, which is about 2013 or 14, a lot of other people I was training with had a fairly clear idea on what they wanted to do. They wanted to work couple stuff or addiction or bereavement, or they'd some sense of what they wanted to do, and I didn't have a clue. And I remember saying that to one of the teachers, like, I don't really have any direction at all. He said, "Relax, something will emerge over time." Give one of these therapist answers, like, it will arrive when it's meant to arrive, all this kind of stuff.
There are two footprints in the sand.
All that, yeah. They're great at giving really non-specific answers, and you come away going, "I don't know really how to take that." Anyway, after a while, then I did various different things and just really got drawn towards the whole area of adolescence.
Right.
So started working in my old school doing a thing, and then just started seeing adolescent clients and their parents.
Wait, so you go into schools and you chat to the kids one-on-one?
I have a job in my old school at the moment.
No.
Again, if you'd have told me 15 years ago I'd be doing this, I'd have laughed at you. I went back in and just put together a kind of mental health module. I just went back to the school and said, "Have you any interest in me doing any mental health stuff with the students?" And they said, "Yeah." So I put together this thing. So every Friday morning I'm there doing a mental fitness classes.
Wow.
With the transition year lads. But in the afternoons, I do a sexual health module.
With the transition year lads? Sir?
Transition year lads. It is the most fun you can possibly have.
Really?
It's amazing. Like, so we obviously cover a lot of things. I do it with a lady called Elaine Burns. She's a psychologist. She does a lot of research in sexual behaviour and consent and stuff like that. So the two of us do it together.
No.
So you cover a lot of these really topics that I'd be really interested to have been brought into my classroom when I was 16. You know, the stuff you don't know anything about, but you want to know, but you don't know who to ask, but it's important and blah, blah, blah. You don't talk to your parents, you can't talk to your teacher. So we kind of put a load of things together and go in, but it's amazing what they know.
Really?
It's amazing. We do this exercise in the first class. Jesus, this chat really is covering a load of different topics, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we do this
I'm
thing.
A great interviewer.
Yeah. we do this thing at the start, and it's kind of like an icebreaker. We get them in little groups with a big sheet of paper, and they write down sexual acts that they're aware of.
Yeah.
And I'd say you ask me at 16, like, how extensive would your list have been?
At 16? Do you want it genuinely?
Genuinely, go on.
Genuinely, my
I'm dying
friend,
to know.
My friend told me what a blowjob was, like the mechanics of a blowjob, and I got sick into my scarf. I got physically...
What age were you?
I was a teen. I was old enough to be embarrassed that I got sick in my scarf. I was in secondary school. I just... Do you know when you just get, like... get sick of the thought of something like touch. It was touch. It was just where she was talking about, like, I don't want to go. I'd make you gawk if I thought about it. But I was just like, and she was like, are you okay? And I was like, yes, it's fine. I had watched Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was 11. I flicked over the telly once and I was just astounded by that. So my first ever experience of like watching sex on telly would be...
I didn't think we were going to go here. But
sorry, but I'm going to ask you the same thing. I don't know. I watched Graham Norton when I was a young one, so I knew what like butt plugs were. But I always thought of it as hilarious. Like it was an abstract concept to me. It was always like a punchline to a joke. It was never like an act that consensual people did for enjoyment. I thought it was just the thing people did that I could laugh at.
Right.
Which is like a very big open into my mind of how fucked up I am. But sorry, yeah, I would have known. I wouldn't known what a blowjob was, but that's about and the other stuff. I don't know. What about you?
Well,
I didn't know like what. I don't know why. Reverse cowgirl. I don't know what that. I still don't know what that is. I have an idea. You just go woo like that.
You can learn in our class.
Yeah, I will say it with the TY lads. Teach me it. You know?
But so the list, like we give them this really big sheet, and the sheet is usually not big enough. It's all from porn.
No.
Like, well, anyone who has an iPhone has access to porn. If you're 16 and you're a bloke and your hormones are flying everywhere, you're going to at some point watch porn. Maybe more than once. And, Jesus, the stuff. Like, I bring in my phone every week for this particular class and just to Google the terms, go on Urban Dictionary.
Wait, is this a separate phone from your normal phone? Is this like a burner sex phone? Where you're just saying?
If anyone ever got hold of my phone... It's got all these search items of the most horrendous.
Your algorithms are ruined now. Yeah. If you ever go onto YouTube.
It was really out there sex acts, which right. An amazing amount of them involve like feces.
Yeah, that does seem
I didn't realise that was as, yeah. Like
feces is the spice of life. Yeah. That's mad. Yeah, that I think young lads expect like a lot more than...
Well,
yeah.
that's our thing. You kind of go, well, if porn is your only teacher about sex, which it is in their case prior to the module,
yeah,
that's their expectations of what it will involve. So if you start watching porn at 12 and you get to 16 or 17 and you're active and you have an expectation based on what you've been watching in movies for 5 or 6 years,
yeah,
and you get into the real world, you're going to get in trouble.
Oh, definitely. I remember once going to the cinema with a lad, and it was my first ever lad with a car. Okay. And I was like, this, a Toyota Starlet. So I was like, oh, this is class. And we went to watch Jumper, and it was a shit film. But I remember, like, he drove me home, but he pulled off at a lake. And, like, I thought, oh, the shift would be grand now. But he pulled out his dick, and he was expecting a hand job. And I was like, I just want to go home. And he's like, but I brought you to the cinema. Like, as if that was a toll. Do you know what I mean? Like, pay the price. I just put on the radio and looked away. Just like, he eventually had to put it back in and drive. And it was silent.
Oh,
and
God.
I never got a text off him again. It's the end of that. But I think that's an expectation. Like, I've definitely heard, like lads are lovely. But, like, sometimes I think there's at least a hand job. Come on now. Do you know that kind of thing?
I'm not sure how to respond to that.
Yeah, sorry, Richie. I'm getting very... you wouldn't hear Graham Norton say
I, do you know what? I on the tip of my tongue is to share a load of my own anecdotes, but I spoke to my mum on the way here tonight, and she said, is that podcast going to go out? Will I be able to listen to it at some point?
Oh, my God. Shit, my mum listens to this.
That's why I'm staying silent in this bit. That's why I'm going into listener mode here.
Yeah.
So any other stories about that kind of stuff?
I don't know. No, that was the only one that was a definite kind of like, his expectation was there. And I was like, oh, you thought like spending €15 on sweets and popcorn is like the equivalent of a hand job. And it's like, no, it's not. I also need to go go-karting as well or something. add in a bit more, like €50. I don't know.
So in our class, we'd be all about communication. So if he had communicated that to us at the start,
I think
that's where he went wrong.
I think communication, I think communication, even from my point of view or women's point of view and men, is really fecked up when it comes to consent. Especially, like, if you hear, there's so many, like, there's so many weird things that have definitely happened where I'm just like, not too bad or anything like that, but definitely things that I should have said, like, I wish there was a radio at every opportunity where someone's brought up something sexual, and I'll just turn it on and look away, do you know? But it's very hard to actually go, I don't feel that comfortable with this. And lads are not psychic, but it's very hard to, it's very hard, especially being a teenager, because you're either a frigid or a whore, and there's no in between. And this has gone very weird now. Mm. But that's generally, I mean, I remember picture messaging was just coming out when I was a young one, and some girl sent a picture of her boobs to a lad, and he was showing everyone in the bus. And I looked, like, because he's just showing everyone, and I was not laughing, because I just felt like he asked her to do that, and now he's making a fool of her. And it's like, it's just very cruel.
Yeah, again, that's a thing that wasn't around when I was that age, but to lads who receive an image like that from a girl they might be seeing, and if they show it to their mates, and the girl happens to be 14, 15 or whatever,
he's
circulating child porn. In the eyes of the law.
Right.
So police get involved in that case. So there's a load of things that kind of young people have to be warned about.
And is that what you're teaching these young lads?
Well, a load of different things.
What would you teach them about consent?
Well, consent is... That's a huge issue for them now, because, again, if you watch porn... It again, depending on what films you watch, it's not uncommon to see a woman resist at the beginning and then a man force themselves on her. And so in some weird way, if you take on board that actually the woman saying no is just part of the process, and that by the end she's going to win her over by overpowering her, and by the end everyone's happy. That's a dangerous message for a young lad to go out into the world with, that actually a woman resisting is just what she does, and that you overrule it and you get past it. So all those kind of things you have to... First of all, you have to be comfortable enough as an adult to go in to teenagers and discuss this, which not everyone is. But if you don't discuss it, if adults just like us just sit amongst themselves and talk about it, no young person learns a thing. You've got to, in some way, engage directly with them. So kind of go in and just tease out what their attitudes are about the whole thing, and then just really tease out the whole area of communication. We don't go in with, and I think some people do when they approach consent from a crime reduction point of view. They go into a group of lads and it's all about the avoidance of rape.
Yeah.
And if it's an all-male audience and your message is to crack down on the rape, the rate of the incidence of rape, implicit in your message is you're all potential rapists and we're here to stop you as being rapists. Now, our first experience of dealing with a group, we're discussing with them consent. When we said, oh, we're here to talk about consent, they all groaned. And we said, why are you groaning? So we've had this before, we get it, don't rape people. And we're going, is that what you think we're here to, is that the message? It was, well, that's what we hear from other people. So our kind of spin on it is, it's not to reduce the crime rate or to focus the talk on the protection of women. It's to enhance the experience for everyone. The more communication there is, just the better the experience is.
That is so true.
They get on board with that.
Yeah.
And you're not in a sideways way accusing them of being a potential rapist either.
No.
So they listen. So particularly with young people, it's not about coming up with a phrase that works or makes sense for me and you. It's about a way of coming up with something that they will make sense of, that they'll understand and they'll connect with.
Wow. Well, we've run out of time.
We've covered a lot.
I feel like we have covered a lot. Jeannie, that's so great that you're teaching young lads about that and that you're taking on that role. Because I think it's a thing that people get very embarrassed about and don't want to talk about, but if you don't talk about
it's loads of fun as well. Like you're laughing constantly in the class because there's a load of nervous energy, and you mention anything about anything, somebody will try and kind of
Would they
like,
go,
break the tension by cracking a joke, and the jokes are always funny.
Yeah.
So it's really fun being in there, but like.
I bet you hear a lot of like, "That's what she said."
Oh, that. Yeah, and you know, jokes about their penis sizes and all the usual stuff. But we do a kind of contraception class where we do get them to do condom demonstrations.
Oh wow.
And I don't know where Elaine got them, but there's these things. They're actual beer goggles. You can put on goggles, and they simulate the vision that you might have if you were drunk.
Whoa.
And then there's other ones that simulate how you might be if you're on pills or on smoking hash or whatever. Yeah. So we get them to do a condom demonstration on like this plastic little knob, and some of them can like nail it first time, and then we get them to put on the goggles.
They feel great.
The goggles, and then they miss it. They miss it completely. So it's a much powerful, a much easier way to get across the point. If you're off your head or drunk, this is going to be harder.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, could be the opposite for some lads now. not in my personal.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I know. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much, Richie.
Thanks,
give it up for Richie Sadler, everyone.
So that was Richie Sadler there. I had a great time with him. I'm going to do the credits. So thank you very much to Sarah Garvey for making the podcast. Thank you very much to Bobby Ahern, who made the theme tune. Thank you very much to William Conway, who I saw in Belfast, and he's doing well. He did the artwork for the Alison Spittle Show. I think I've woken up my boyfriend. Have I? Ah, sure. That's the risk when you make podcasts. You gotta break some eggs, you know? So yeah, there's gonna be a few live shows. The Warrior Princess tour has finished. But I'm doing a few live shows now, so I'm going to talk to you about them right now. Do you know what I'm doing today? Today I'm filming a film. I got a very small part in a film, and I'm very excited. So, on the 27th of April, that's this Friday, I'm in the LOL in Knoll, so the Knoll Arts Centre. Then the 2nd of May, I'm doing Head Stuff lectures. I'm looking after the ship while Garrod Farley is gone. Then we got Kilkenny from the 31st until the 3rd of June. And then on the 11th of May is a special one. It's me, David O'Doherty, Catherine Bohart, Kevin McGahern, Hannah Mamelis, Garrod Farley, and a few others are taking part in a comedy night in the Workmen's. That's the 11th of May, that's on a Friday, and we're trying to raise money for Together for Yes, which wouldn't make sense, but we're trying to raise money for Together for Yes, and it's going to be a great night of comedy, and you should come down. And that is all. That is all. Have I got anything funny to tell you? No, do you know, I'm just so excited. I'm going to go see my friend Rosie today and her baba. I'm going to get the train down. I'm going to take out my laptop, like I'm going to work on the train, but then not work on the train. These are all my plans. I love being on a train. I love, I used to do fake names on a train. Like, in Ireland, you can put fake names on a ticket and it'll come up on the seat itself, digitally. And I used to... One time I thought it'd be funny if I pretended I was Kanye West. This is years ago now. And the train got full up and people were sitting in my seat. And I had to say, excuse me, I'm Kanye West, and then show them my ticket, and well, that kicked the wind out of my sails now for doing any more jokes in the future. So I just stick to my name. But yeah, that's my anecdote at the end of the podcast. Bet you're glad you stayed listening. I'm sorry. No, I'm not going to end the podcast on an apology. That's not a good way to go about it. I'll end it on a quote. I'll Google a quote. Repeat or copy out, brackets, words from a text or speech written or spoken by another person. There we go. There's a quote. The best preparation for tomorrow is doing your best today. That's H. Jackson Brown Jr. I agree. All right, chickens. Have a great night. Bye.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.